The Dharma, incomparably profound and exquisite, is rarely met with even in hundreds of thousands of millions of kalpas. We now can see it, hear it, accept and hold it. May we realize the true mind of the Tathagata. Today is day two of this seven-day sesshin here at Mountain Gate in northern New Mexico in November 2015. And every so often we hear a great big whomp, which is the snow sliding off the upper roofs. It is a typical New Mexico winter day where the sun is shining brightly and melting snow left and right. There's still quite a bit of snow left. We had more than a foot of snow just a few days ago, and it doesn't vanish instantly, although it does go faster than it does at sea level, because our sun is so brilliant up here, a mile and a half closer to the sun than anyone who is living at sea level. There is a saying in Zen, a bodhisattva leaves no traces. A bodhisattva leaves no traces. This has both a sort of a normal day-to-day meaning, and it also has a profound meaning. The normal day-to-day meaning, as we do our Zen training, we work earnestly not to leave a trail, not to leave doors open when they should be closed, for that matter, not to slam doors. Then that's a difficult one here at Mountain Gate, where these double doors at the front entrance are what is at the moment of at the front entrance, and eventually will be not the front entrance anymore. But it's difficult to get that one door to latch. And it isn't necessary, however, to slam it in order to have that happen. But you have to have some strength to pull it to and continue pulling until you hear that click of the hardware going into the hole where it will stay latched. Other things, like when we go up to the dining area or to the kitchen and have our supper and we sit down at the table, not to leave the chairs awry, but to put the chairs back neatly into place at the table. Not to leave our dishes lying around. Make sure that when we drop things on the counter or that we pick them up or clean them up. And when we come back in, when we put our shoes on the shoe rack, to put them neatly. One of the things that struck me many, many years ago when I first went to Japan, that was in 1963, on our way to Burma, with the Foreign Service, and we stayed 3 days. Well, it was originally going to be 3 days, but because of both my infant son, Greg, and I got some pretty bad infections, throat infections, in the flight over, and we ended up staying a couple more days. But at any rate, after we got well enough to wander out and about and see what was going on outside the hotel, we went around the neighborhood, walked around the neighborhood, and it was so interesting to see the shoes neatly lined up at the doors, to see the bedding. It's so damp in Japan that people, when there's a sunny day, take the opportunity to put the bedding out in the sun to dry out, because otherwise you're going to be sleeping in a bed of mold, particularly during the rainy season. But as people put their bedding out, hung their bedding over their balconies, it was done in a very neat way. There was obviously a lot of attention paid to how people did things back then. Nowadays it's a little bit less so in Japan, Over the years that I lived there and then continued to going back for several months at a time each year, it was clear that the culture was beginning to shift into something more akin to our Western culture where people didn't pay so much attention. I remember at one point taking somebody to the train station in Okayama after a sesshin, and I was driving to the train station, and I was about to make a left turn, and I stopped short because there was a bicycle coming across the road. And the man on the bicycle looked at me with utter confidence and no fear at all, understanding clearly that I would stop. And yet in America, I've just recently read that there's a rise in bike accidents as more and more people take to bicycles for fun and also just exercise and to do errands. And we're not as attentive and aware as we need to be as we're driving, as we're walking, as we're living. A bodhisattva leaves no traces. That requires fundamental awareness, attention to everything we're doing. We don't want to leave behind stuff for somebody else to have to deal with. That's not very kind, and it's also not very responsible. There's a deeper meaning a bodhisattva leaves no traces. And that is when we are completely let go, there's no energy around a me doing something. I had a very interesting experience of this when I was living in Japan. Before I left to go live in Japan, I had a double whammy of illnesses which left me quite physically drained and with the right side of my face paralyzed. And in fact, I looked like a Halloween nightmare with that part of my face sort of sagging off my chin, unable to control my eye and that side and so forth. And during my time in Japan, it began to come back. The cause of the illness, or the cause of the situation with my face, was that I had had meningitis and encephalitis, and out of that came a secondary infection that killed back the seventh facial nerve on the right side of my face. And as the neurologist who examined me commented, yes, it's 100% gone, all the way back to behind my ear. When an infection happens in such a nerve, the nerve goes through a bony channel in your mastoid bone behind your ear and then into your face, where it spreads into several different paths. And when it is infected, it swells up. And that's what happened. It got so swollen that it cut off its own blood supply and killed itself. It took a long time for it to grow back, and when it did, it didn't grow back 100% where it normally would have because of the scar tissue. And so when I was in Japan at Sogenji, it had started to come back, and I was able to have some movement around my eye and a little bit around my mouth. And then it grew back further and again in not in its normal channel. And what it was creating was what looked like a permanent sneer on my face. And I thought, how am I going to live in society looking like this? I'd already had the experience of people running away from me, kids bursting into tears when they saw me, when my face was completely gone. And And so it was pretty clear that if I had a permanent sneer on my face, unless I had managed somehow to cover it up, I'm not quite sure how I would have done that, that it still would not have been something where anybody wanted to come anywhere near me. How would I be able to teach under those circumstances? How would I be able to live in society? It felt like I was going to have to go live in the woods alone when I eventually returned from Japan. At that time, there was a visitor to the temple, a very unusual visitor. He was a friend of the Roshi's who had met him in Switzerland through a mutual friend, a student of the Roshi's who lived there. He had been a bass guitarist with a very famous rock band that was touring in the world numerous times. I don't recall the name of the band, but it was famous enough that they played concerts to 20,000 people in Madison Square Gardens. They had X number of platinum records, X number of gold records. They were at the top of the charts. And one day he was coming out of a publicity party for the band at 5 o'clock in the morning in England, in London, and woke up 6 weeks later in the hospital, completely blind, completely mute, and completely paralyzed. The only thing he could do was hear. He'd been stabbed in the heart. When I met him, it was 16 years after the event. At the time, he was married and had a one-year-old son. So I guess it was 15 years later that I met him, because by that time his son was 16 years old. His wife left him, and he spent his hours and minutes and days and months working on healing himself, which he did to a remarkable extent. The doctors had told him he was clinically dead 6 to 8 minutes, which would have normally been the end of him, in the normal sense of the word, but he survived. He had some side effects, but not really much noticeable. And one day he said, "I'd like to go for a walk with you." He had brought his girlfriend along on the trip. They were going to India, where he went regularly. And I said, "You know, you got your girlfriend along. Why don't I just tell you where it'd be interesting to walk around here in the neighborhood, and you two could go for a walk." "No, I want to walk with you." So we went for a walk, and not so far away from Sogenji is a Shinto shrine up a very tall stairway on top of a little hill, and we started up the stairway. And we got about two-thirds of the way up, and he said, "Stop a minute, I want to look at you." So he stood in front of me, a couple of feet away, and started putting his hands out in front of him, not touching me, but moving from my head downward. And there was something about the process that made me close my eyes. It felt like something very important was going on here, and I didn't want to interrupt it by having any visual images. When I closed my eyes, I was struck by the fact that there was no sense of anybody standing in front of me. Not a single sense of anyone standing in front of me. Now, normally, when we move past people, whenever we're walking past people or sitting near people, there's a sense of their energy. We close our eyes, and it's very clear that somebody's sitting near us or somebody's walking near us. But in this case, no. This bodhisattva left no traces. And bodhisattva he was, because whatever he did, he undid the sneer. And he said, "There, I've just untied a knot in your solar plexus. Within a few hours, your face will be back much more to normal." And I asked him, at the time, because it really was not close to normal. It was getting there slowly, but it wasn't close to normal. I said, "Will I ever look normal again?" And he hesitated, and he said, "Yes." But he removed the sneer. There was nobody there doing anything. In a collection of capping phrases called Zen Sand, a translation called Zen Sand, done by a good Dharma friend, Sogen Hori, who's a retiring professor at McGill University in Canada. He is a Zen Buddhist monk, a Rinzai monk, trained for, I think it was something like 14 years in Rinzai monasteries in Japan, and went deep enough in his practice that he was working on subsequent koans. In the Rinzai system, there are certain koans that we work on where once we are passed on a koan, given permission to go further in the practice, we are usually asked to bring in what's called a go, or a jaku go, a capping phrase, is what it's called in English. And it's an excellent practice, because in order to solve a koan, you have to go beyond words. It's essential. You cannot solve a koan through words. There may be words, possibly in some rare instances, that are answers to particular koans, but in order to fathom the essence of the koan, you have to go beyond words. And that is true for every koan there is, whether it's your breakthrough koan or a subsequent koan. But then, to bring in a capping phrase, there's this very thick book of fragments of poetry, of comments of Zen masters, of encounters between Zen masters and students, brief bits of poems, some of them Chinese poetry, ancient Chinese classical poetry. And you go through this book and you find the jakugo that fits exactly, that expresses in words the essence of the koan that you just solved. And this is a very, very vital aspect of Rinzai practice, where you not only are required to comprehend the essence of the koan, but then you're asked as well to be able to express it in words. And this helps with the integration of the understanding of that koan in our daily life. And so we have this great big thick collection that Gen-san titled Zen Sand. It comes down to us from actually before Hakuin. Hakuin sort of reorganized the koan system in Rinzai Zen. And so the various different collections of these jakugo, Sogen-san studied extensively, in part because he translated them, a lot of them, in the course of his own practice. And in fact, when I first went to Sogenji, we were using an old typewritten copy of his translations. Eventually he took a sabbatical from McGill, came to Japan, and completed the book for publication, and now it's available as Zen Sand. You can get it on Amazon.com, and it's also now out in paperback, and it is something that every Zen student should, or at least every Rinzai Zen student who's interested in pursuing koan work, should get a copy of. It also has some quite wonderful jakugo in it. And some of these express that that no traces, which is our fundamental being. There's one long one. They are categorized according to number of characters that comprise these jakugo. And in the 20s, there's one that reads, "There is something prior to heaven and earth, formless, originally silent and solitary, master of the 10,000 things. It follows the four seasons and never wanes." There's something prior to heaven and earth. This is what we're searching for. Who am I? We're reaching to comprehend, to experience this something that is prior to heaven and earth. This something that is nothing, that is never born and never dies. This true nature of each one of us. There is something prior to heaven and earth. Formless, originally silent and solitary, master of the 10,000 things, it follows the four seasons and never wanes. It's always there. No matter what kind of a mind state you might find yourself in, particularly during Sesshin, where our mind state tends to fluctuate between positive and negative, and we have moments of exhilaration or at least positive sense of things, and then we fall into despair, assuming that we will never make it, that we're incapable of opening to our true nature, that it's hopeless. But that's not the case. This something prior to heaven and earth, formless, silent and solitary, is always there. It cannot be gotten rid of. It's who we really are. Master the 10,000 things, it follows the four seasons and never wanes. It's always responsive, not reactive, and never ceases to be. Take heart in that. The next time you're feeling down in the dumps, it's always there. There's not a single being in the universe that can possibly step outside of it. And some of its qualities? In the eights, we find this capping phrase. Lacquer does not mind being black. Powder does not mind being white. Lacquer does not mind being black. Powder does not mind being white. The great way is not difficult for those who do not pick and choose. Of course, there are times when we need to judge. But in general, no. It's not necessary, but it's an intense habit pattern for people, and it causes no end of despair and suffering. This whole thing that happened with the massacre in Paris was a result of judgment. People that did it were convinced that anybody who didn't believe as they did should be killed. So they were going to help make that happen. Judgment leaves traces. A bodhisattva leaves no traces. This beingness of the universe that is silent and solitary before heaven and earth has no traces. What is it? How to get there? There's another one in the 14s. What guts to throw away 1,000 gold cash at once? Not even four walls to his house, yet he knows no poverty. This is a commentary on an ancient Chinese layman who decided that, he was quite wealthy actually, and he decided that his money would only be a source of suffering to people, and so he took it out into the middle of the lake and dropped it overboard. It's interesting that our term cash comes from the Chinese, where coins made of gold or copper or some other precious metal were strung on ropes or strings, and that was called cash. Now our cash is paper money, in some cases a few coins, or more likely an account in a bank. But in those days it was easy to get rid of all of this cash. All they had to do was take it out in the boat and dump it overboard. People were horrified. And the rest of the saying, his house doesn't even have four walls, but he knows no poverty. When we let go everything, that's when that be beyond heaven and earth, before heaven and earth can rise and be expressed in everything we do or say or think. And we leave no traces when that occurs. To let go of our ideas about things, in particular our idea about ourselves, we have such images. I can't do this. I have to do that. I'm this kind of a person. I had this kind of a history. And it's marked me. And it's permanent. Well, it's not. It's an experience that we had. It's permanent if we drag it around with us forever and ever. But we don't need to do that. And so often in doing so, we not only create pain for ourselves, but we also act out in ways that creates pain for others as well. We're certainly not leaving no traces. Moonlight pierces to the bottom of the pool, yet not a wave is disturbed. Can we live like that? So that everything is done completely and without drag on it? So that we can do it without bringing in our self-image? Can we so be so completely one with what we're doing that there's nobody doing it? This is the path to freedom. This is what we were born to live. This is how we did as small children, exploring this new universe, banging the spoon on the table, getting to know the quality of spoon, putting the toy in the mouth, getting to know the quality of the toy. No ideas about it ahead of time. It's interesting that my younger great-grandson, who's a joyful little guy, 2 years old, although he'll soon be three, they have a Dachshund, and he loves to walk the dog. And he and the dog are about the same size ratio. And so there was this wonderful photograph of him starting out walking the dog. He and mom and big brother, who's four, were out for a walk, waiting for daddy to come home. And then the next photograph is Archer sound asleep on the grass, the leash next to him, the dog sitting patiently. He just got tired. So he just lay down and went to sleep. right there with his feet still on the sidewalk. How innocent can we be? No ideas about it. None whatsoever. He got tired, so he just went to sleep. What else do you do when you get tired? No traces. This is what we are yearning to get back to, because the traces are a prison. Our ideas about ourselves, our ideas about others, our ideas about situations, our conditioning, all adds up to a prison. Through our practice, we can break out of that prison. We can see it for what it is, a series of concepts born of experiences with no bearing on reality at the moment. And if we dare to throw our cash overboard and live without those ideas about life and about ourselves in particular, but living from a deeper place that we access through our practice, then we do flow with life, we do respond, and we don't leave traces. This is what we all yearn for. We have a sixth sense that this is possible. And we yearn for the utter freedom that this provides, because it does provide utter freedom. Even if we're in the midst of prison, yet we are free when we have reached this ability to be let go to that point. As part of the process, we open to where we are caught in self-identity. If we've had traumatizing experiences, which so many people who come to Zen have had, then to a certain degree they need to be worked through, but they need also to be eventually let go of, to truly be free. And as you continue deepening your practice in this sesshin, and hopefully as well in further sesshin, this is the process that you'll undergo. To do so knowing that you're on the bodhisattva path, that if you continue, you'll reach a point of ultimately not leaving any traces. And along the way, you'll be able to be there for people who are suffering. You will be able to relieve suffering. The bodhisattva work. So, keep going. Dive in. Have faith that you can realize this because you can. And you will find that it is incredibly worth it. It means letting go of our toys. And sometimes we don't want to do that. It means walking into the unknown. Because without our toys, who are we? And yet that's an essential part of the practice. And if we do live walking into the unknown, then we aren't dragging in any walls to prevent us from moving in any direction essential to liberation of ourselves or of others. And that's huge. So keep going. Dive deep. I thank you for listening. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.